From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. The Biden administration is releasing more oil from the country's Strategic Petroleum Reserve. This comes as a gallon of gas in the U.S. is, on average, $1.30 higher than a year ago. And it's not just American sticker shock. China and India and other countries are releasing oil from their reserves. Let's talk about this with Vijay Vaitheeswaran. He's Global Energy and Climate Innovation Editor for The Economist. Vijay, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Now, the administration is releasing an extra 32 million barrels of oil from their announcement. That's like 2 days of oil consumption in the U.S. If they want to push gas prices down, is this enough?
So there's a couple of ways to look at this. The short answer is no, it's not enough. A very cynical answer is this is a political ploy and may even leave us in a worse position. A more optimistic answer is, look, we don't have a lot of tools to deal with a difficult global economy and an oil cartel that manipulates prices. It's a game of poker, and the president is doing the best he can with a limited number of tools. And one of the tools any U.S. president has, and previous ones have used this, is a release of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserves. It's going to have a short-term effect. Indeed, it already had because they had been talking about it before they did it. But what it means is we don't have that oil a second time to use if there is a real emergency. This is meant to be used in case of, let's say, war or physical disruption of oil. We don't have that. So we're actually putting ourselves in a slightly precarious position by beginning to use our emergency stocks.
Now, you mentioned this cartel. Is this reflecting frustration that a lot of, I guess, net consumer countries have with OPEC and Russia? We know they've been reluctant to open the taps.
This is exactly right, that we are in a global energy crunch at the moment, and it's something that affects oil markets, but it's also affected the natural gas markets. In Europe, there's a shortage of natural gas going into winter, and a basic reason for this is the pandemic led to a dramatic drop in demand, and people underinvested or cut back investments in production in those fuels. We had a much faster than expected recovery, which is a good thing, right? It's a good thing that Americans are driving a lot and feel safe enough to want to get together for Thanksgiving and fly for the holidays. Those are wonderful things. But it's happened at such a pace that the fossil fuel markets haven't had time to respond with new investment. Time will solve this problem. But there's a political problem that right now the White House is dealing with concerns about inflation. This provides a short-term palliative. And they know this. They're playing a game of poker with OPEC. And by doing it in a concerted fashion with other countries, I think it actually sends a stronger signal that OPEC may need to respond.
And as far as these other countries, right, we know this is a coordinated effort. Other countries, China, India, Japan, South Korea, Britain, are also releasing their emergency oil. How might the economics work here? We do know oil is a global market. Prices are set by world supply and world demand, right?
That's right. And so from the economics and markets perspective, this is not very significant. And that's because the amount of oil is not very much compared to the daily flows of oil or the annual production of the big countries. And secondly, the way markets work, they anticipate the news, right? So the markets had already pulled back on oil prices in anticipation of something like this happening because President Biden had talked about it repeatedly and his people had talked about it. And so they were hoping that jawboning would be enough to get OPEC to agree to increase production, but OPEC did not take the bait. They didn't agree to it. And so now they were put in a position of put up or shut up, so they actually are releasing some oil. I think this is really more about geopolitical strategy and politics than it is about the true economics of oil.
Now, as this geopolitics is playing out, this messaging is playing out, aren't we seeing pressure for oil prices to fall already? I've read production is coming up in much of the world and demand may be falling off with the lockdowns in Europe.
The real solution when it comes to oil markets, the oldest saying is the best cure for high prices is high prices. The challenge is there's a lag period. You can't just turn on the taps and have oil the very next day. Then in the meanwhile, we're going into winter when, you're right, we might see a bigger coronavirus outbreak. We're seeing it in Europe already, countries going into lockdown. And if we do see demand fall again, that's what OPEC is guarding against. They don't believe this recovery is permanent. They don't want to get caught out with a price collapse. And so both sides are watching the uncertainty of the global economy and making different bets.
That's Vijay Vaitheeswaran, Global Energy and Climate Innovation Editor for The Economist. Thanks much for the time.
Thank you.
Well, to the Capitol now, where the clock is ticking for Congress to pass President Biden's landmark Build Back Better bill. The House approved the bill last week. It's now in the Senate, where Democratic holdouts Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema stand in its way. As you may know, the bill would expand the social safety net, provide subsidies for health care and child care, help fight climate change. Oh, but maybe you don't know what the bill would do. And historian Julian Zelizer says that's part of the president's problem. Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. He often joins us for historical perspective. And Julian, you say telling stories is what presidents do. So are you saying Biden didn't do that?
I don't think he's done enough of it. You know, legislation doesn't sell itself. And historically, one of the functions of a president who has a bold agenda is to explain to the country what these expenditures are going to do, how they will improve their lives, and how they will alleviate some of the crises of the moment. And I think Biden, in some ways, has overcorrected from the former President Trump, who was out there all the time, and he hasn't done enough of what many people think is some mysterious reconciliation package.
Well, and they think it's too expensive. And you know, Biden supporters blame the media for focusing more on the infighting of the Democratic Party between progressives and the moderate holdouts who mentioned Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. In your view, is that fair criticism of the media? And I guess, you know, if not, why hasn't Biden made the case?
Well, the media does what the media does, and all presidents are frustrated with the media, and there's some merit to the criticism for sure. But you know, that's the world that the president has to live in. So I think it's really incumbent on the administration to say this isn't just about $1.7 trillion. It's about, you know, paid child care leave and drug prices and preschool and affordable housing, and to really connect the dots between the dollars that will be spent and the benefits that will that Americans will feel. So you can't wish the way the media works away, and instead what an administration has to do is make sure the message is delivered.
And by the way, the Congressional Budget Office came back with a better-than-expected report on what the plan will cost, and the Democrats have been saying they want to pay for it by requiring the very, very rich in America to pay their fair share of taxes. But now critics are pointing to inflation that we're seeing now and saying, well, this is why we can't afford the plan. How should, in your view, and in your historical view, how might the administration offset that criticism?
It's a tough one, and they shouldn't underestimate the power of inflation as a political issue. Even if the inflation is short-term or transitory or in the larger picture doesn't define the economy, it can be used against them. So I think Biden has to explain not why this legislation is necessary despite inflation, but how it will actually control the costs for families on key items, such as child care, so that this isn't an anti-inflationary measure, but just the opposite. It's actually an effort to deal with underlying price pressures that American families feel all the time.
Yeah. Give us some historical examples of presidents who you feel have made the case for big legislation like this.
Yeah, Franklin Roosevelt was the best at it. I mean, every little part of the expansion of government that he pushed in the 1930s, from public works to the Tennessee Valley Authority to Social Security, was always connected to the grand economic crisis that this country was living in. He did it in World War II. Also, when he expands the income tax system, he has a whole promotional campaign using Irving Berlin songs and Donald Duck cartoons to teach Americans how tax money was going to go to defeat fascism overseas. So he's the great example of how presidents can do this.
Yeah. And by the way, you say a good example of it not done well is Harry Truman and the Fair Deal.
Sure. That's one of the slogans that didn't lead to legislation. It was his version of the New Deal. And in the end, he wasn't able to sell the program in a way that could overcome the conservative opposition in Congress.
So here we have what's called moderate opposition from Senators Manchin and Sinema. You know, should the White House enlist Sesame Street? You know, it's the same as the cartoons of the past. Or what kind of messaging can you see?
Well, he has to explain in the short term, really, to voters in Arizona and West Virginia why they need to demand that their senators support this. He has to outline two or three of the big benefits that would be received in this state to make voters' lives better. That's the only way to change the position of the two senators, for them to hear from their own constituents rather than the White House why this legislation is essential.
And by the way, in the few seconds we have, we should mention President Johnson's Great Society. He was taken down by the Vietnam War, but his Great Society, he explained.
Absolutely. When he pushed Medicare in 1965, he didn't give theoretical arguments about government. He said, this is the benefit elderly Americans were going to have. They wouldn't have to fear not being able to go to the hospital. And those are the kinds of models the president needs to look back on.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And by the way, happy Thanksgiving upcoming to you.
To you as well.
So in this crazy COVID economy, some baby boomers are seeing their home values surge and their retirement pots of money really swell. And for them, maybe it is the end of the rainbow, or at least the end of being a working stiff. Is it time to retire early? Let's talk this through and do some numbers with Michelle Singletary. She's personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. Michelle, welcome back.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, you write in your article on this, in your column, that your 26-year-old daughter recently joked that she was ready to hang it up. Ha ha. But the numbers of retirees have actually surged in the pandemic. What do you make of it? Why?
Well, you know, a couple of things happen. Obviously, we're, you know, still in the middle of a pandemic. And many people who may have been thinking about retirement but just sort of holding on realize, you know what, life is too short. You see people getting sick and dying. And then maybe they've got a long commute and they weren't, you know, really happy with their job, or they're at the end of their career and they're tired. And my retirement, you know, portfolio is doing extremely well despite the pandemic, and it's a good time to say, you know what, I'm done.
Well, let's walk through this question of done and whether it works for those considering early retirement. And one of your first questions is, how much will you be spending per month? Right, there's mortgage or rent or food; those maybe are more predictable. But in retirement, what expenses might really grow that we have to think about?
Well, for one thing, health care. As we're getting older, there's more costs for that. Perhaps you want to move, there's moving costs. So there's a lot of things to consider. And oftentimes people think once they retire, their expenses are going to go down significantly. Sometimes people think, you know, it's going to cut in half. But in fact, most experts say you should expect to spend still between 70 and 80% of your pre-retirement income, just as you would if you were working. So it's not just you're replacing the working costs with other costs. But let's just take a step back, though. Even before you do your retirement budget, you need to consider where all your income is going to come from retirement. So you want to look at if you're eligible for Social Security, if you got a pension, you know, your savings. You want to get a grasp of everything that's coming in. And it sounds like, of course, people would do that. But I'm telling you, I've met so many people who said, you know what, I'm so tired, I'm ready to quit. And they retire and they haven't done this exercise.
Okay, I'm glad you mentioned this, because I pulled my own Social Security statement as I got ready to talk to you, Michelle. And this is really something. If I retire at 70, I'm going to get almost $4,000 per month in Social Security. Mm-hmm. If I retire at 62, I get about half of that. That's really something.
Right. That's right. That's right. And lots of people don't factor that in. And we know that about 58% of Americans rely on Social Security as their main source of income. And so you have to ask, can I, if you're in that group, can I live on that money if I collect it at 62, which is the earliest you can collect it? Now, you know, there's a lot of discussion about early or late when to take Social Security. So yeah, you're going to get that for, you know, almost 4,000 if you wait till 70. But there are a lot of years between 62 and 70 that you could be getting that money and doing the things that you want to do in life. If you've got other sources of income, you're trying, your investment portfolio and savings, you could be using that money to do all the traveling you want, because we know not everybody, but as you get older, you slow down, you have more health issues. So perhaps you'll start having issues, health issues in your 70s or 80s when you aren't going to be able to travel. So you could have used that money. So it's not sort of a one thing fits all.
Now, part of that exercise on the income side is, of course, the stock market. and people's retirement money, a lot of it being there. Before we started rolling, we talked about my own kids. I mean, they have a few pennies in the market, and they're so excited because it's doing so well.
Yeah.
We do know the market giveth and the market taketh away. Right? It's had this great run. But as I think about retirement, should I think about, you know, this might plunge early in my retirement, and I have to kind of think that through?
That's exactly right. I mean, it just seems so counterintuitive that when people have lost their jobs and people are struggling to pay rent, that the market has just, you know, skyrocketed. Now, it did take, it has taken some significant dips, but overall, if you've invested fairly well, you've done really well the last 2 years. I know my own portfolio has done exceptionally well, but as all professionals will tell you, past results are not indicative of future results.
That's why they say it.
That's why they say it. So you got to look at that that way, that over time, you may not see the kind of returns that you have now. And then you've got to think about, okay, so how much should I be pulling from my investment portfolio on a yearly basis once I retire? So obviously, you can't be pulling out 20 and 30% every year. And so generally, experts recommend about a 4% withdrawal rate. However, Morningstar.
Yeah, I've been reading that for years, that's been gospel, at least until recently, yeah?
That's exactly right. And so Morningstar had this great report that looked at perhaps for some people, it actually might be a lower withdrawal rate, maybe like 3.3% is what Morningstar recommended. But it could be more. If you've got a lot of money stashed away, you could take out 5%.
Now, finally, for us to even think through whether we're on track here or whether we're ready to hang it up and our money's in good shape here, you're suggesting going to a financial planner. How can we use financial planners to help us even give us a sense of whether we're on track?
You know, I love, whenever you mention that, people think, well, why should I pay some money to have somebody tell me how much money I should have?
Yeah, yeah.
And I always say, if you had some major dental issue, you need a root canal, you're not going to try to do your own root canal. So you need a professional to help you figure this out if you aren't good at this yourself. And many people can do it themselves. But listen, I can do it myself, but I've also hired financial planners to make sure that I'm on track. So it's a second opinion. And I think it's definitely worth the money because once you retire, and if you're not going to be working, you've got to live off of the money and or pensions and savings that you have. And you want to make sure it lasts as long as you last.
Michelle Singletary writes the Color of Money column for The Washington Post. Michelle, always great to talk to you. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Oh, you too. Thank you.
NASA plans to launch a spacecraft as early as tomorrow morning to try to change the trajectory of an asteroid, which can come in handy if the Earth is ever threatened by a big rock from space, which can happen. NASA's Planetary Defense Office developed the project, and NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports.
NASA keeps watch on the biggest asteroids around Earth. For the foreseeable future, none are a threat. But there are plenty of smaller rocks, the size that could take out a city, that still haven't been found and tracked. The space agency is working on a new telescope to search for more, and it's also about to make its first ever attempt to knock an asteroid off course. Nancy Chabot is this mission's coordination lead. She's a scientist at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory.
A lot of times when I tell people that NASA is actually doing this mission, they kind of don't believe it at first. Maybe because it has been the thing of movies.
It's the size of Texas, Mr. President. It's what we call a global killer, the end of mankind. Half the world be incinerated by the heat blast.
You know, movies like Armageddon, which featured Bruce Willis trying to blow up an incoming asteroid with a nuclear bomb. There won't be quite as much drama with NASA's Double Asteroid Redirection Test, or DART.
So DART is demonstrating asteroid deflection. It is absolutely not asteroid disruption, which is how it goes a lot of times in the movies.
Rather than trying to obliterate an asteroid, DART will just give one a little nudge by ramming a spacecraft into it. have no fear. The target asteroid is no danger now, and there's no chance that this mission could send it careening towards us.
There is absolutely no way that the DART pest is a threat to the Earth.
Chabot says the DART spacecraft will travel over 6 million miles to a big asteroid that's orbited by a smaller asteroid. It's the smaller one that's the target. The space rock is about 500 feet across.
And so it's like a small golf cart running into a great pyramid.
Except this golf cart will be going 15,000 miles per hour. The impact will happen next autumn. Elena Adams is a mission systems engineer at the Applied Physics Laboratory. She says in the last few hours, she and her colleagues will simply watch and wait as the spacecraft homes in on its target, sending pictures back to Earth as it gets closer and closer.
It is 4 hours of watching paint dry, but kind of terrifying at the same time because the spacecraft is completely autonomous.
In the final seconds before impact, scientists will get their first good look at this space rock. It's so small and so far away, the telescopes can't really see it. Instead, they see this pair of asteroids as little more than a point of light. But it dims whenever the small asteroid passes in front of its larger companion. It normally orbits once every 11 hours and 55 minutes, but the impact should slightly shorten that time period. By how many minutes? No one knows. Adams says everyone will watch closely.
And just see how does it react to being pushed.
She says this test should help NASA understand what its options are if it ever spots a space rock headed this way. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
Silicon Valley's youngest female self-made billionaire resumes testimony in court today. Elizabeth Holmes, founder of the failed blood testing company Theranos, is accused of duping investors. Joining us to talk about it is Nancy Gertner, former federal judge and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Nice to have you with us.
Nice to be on.
Now, on the stand yesterday, Holmes described the blood testing technology her company developed to identify disease, and she talked about the company's partnerships with some big-name drug companies. What has struck you so far about her testimony?
Well, what she wants to do is to show that her hopes and dreams, the mantra in Silicon Valley is fake it until you make it. And so the notion would be that she had great hopes for this technology, that she'd intended to defraud no one, that she, to the extent there were errors, they were rookie mistakes, and that's not criminal. And she wants to persuade the jury of her good faith so that that aura will then cover over to the harder parts of her cross-examination.
Yeah. Now, today she's scheduled to testify again for the third day. What is her defense team hoping to achieve by putting her on the stand?
Well, the clearly at the beginning she'll talk about what her hopes and dreams were for this and the initial very promising reports of tests. At some point, that begins to change, and the moment that it begins to change, that is to say when it's clear that it wasn't delivering on the results that people anticipated, the question is, what did she know and when she knew it? And my understanding is that she wants essentially to immunize the jury against the attacks that will come. She wants to be able to suggest that people didn't tell her the truth or that she was essentially, as she'll say, we believe, exploited by her by the CEO of the company with whom she was having an affair. So it's a question of building up good faith to immunize her against what the prosecution will do, which will be a series of text messages indicating that she knew things, a series of emails suggesting that she knew things. But they want to build up a head of steam before that moment.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit more about the prosecution. It rested last week. What more have we heard from that side?
Well, you'll now hear the prosecution put under her nose, under Elizabeth Holmes' nose, what the text messages and the comments that were made to investors and to pharmacies. And my understanding, there were text messages that indicated that she was aware of the technical problems. There was some indication that she was aware of faked demonstrations. So what they would do essentially is to put this in front of her and try to show the jury that the person that's on trial is that person and not the person that's being shown in the in her testimony, her initial testimony.
And very quickly, do you have a thought to share on the backdrop of this? Elizabeth Holmes was a rock star CEO. What is the failure of this company kind of added to the broader conversation in Silicon Valley?
Well, I have to admit that I see it through feminist lenses. Rather, she was the first woman, sort of the female Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
She was showing her competence and strength in this area, and her public statements reflected that. On trial today, she's trying to portray a different person, naive, inexperienced, and overwhelmed by the men around her.
That's Nancy Gertner, former federal judge and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School.
Frances Haugen, the former Facebook employee who went public with allegations that Facebook knowingly hid research showing that its products, including Instagram, amplified hate, misinformation, and political unrest, was the latest in a long line of whistleblowers. Back in 2014, there was John Tighe, then a State Department employee, who revealed that the National Security Agency was running a secret spying program targeting Americans. Well, John Tighe now runs what you might call a whistleblower school, a not-for-profit that helps would-be whistleblowers sound the alarm in the most effective and safest way. And among his recent clients was Frances Haugen. So we've brought John in for some tips. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And I know there's sort of like a client privilege that you have with Frances Haugen, but can you just tell us generally, we're going to go through the tips for people in general, but what was something that you feel she benefited from maybe speaking with you?
She is an amazing example of how powerful whistleblowers can be if they get good advice on how to stay safe, on how to follow the law so that they're not prosecuted or sued, and how to have the biggest impact. One of the things we did in that case and many other cases is we started with disclosures to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. And for employees in the private sector, the SEC often is the first place to go because ever since 2010, they've had an office of the whistleblower whose job is to receive disclosures and to protect whistleblowers coming out of the private sector.
Well, I wouldn't even have known that. And by the way, that's like number four on your list of what to do. But what you're illustrating here is the first thing to do is not to go running out into the street waving some documents saying, I found this out. So start with number one.
Talk to a lawyer. Don't talk to your friends. Don't talk to your boss. Don't talk to a journalist. Ideally, contact the lawyer using a secure mechanism. So either meet them in person with no microphones around or use the Signal app to speak to them, which is not as secure, but kind of the most secure option you have for a voice call. And understand the legal risks that you face and how to make lawful disclosures in a way that you're protected.
You mentioned Signal. This is an encrypted phone messaging app.
Kind of like WhatsApp, but it's even more secure.
Okay. And just staying with lawyers for a second, lawyers can get expensive. What if people are like, I can't afford a lawyer?
Well, my organization, Whistleblower Aid, we're a charity, a not-for-profit legal organization that does give free advice. So you can get in touch with us over Signal or over an even more secure system called SecureDrop. Or often lawyers will give you free consultation. So if you have another firm that you trust, see if they'll at least advise you on your rights.
They may say, for instance, as you do, that if there's some sort of monetary damages, that's the only time that you might take a percentage of that, but otherwise, no. And a legal firm might say the same thing.
Yeah, at Whistleblower Aid, everything we do for clients is free unless we win money for them, and then we sort of follow an industry standard for taking a percentage as the legal fee.
Okay, so get a lawyer. Make sure that lawyer understands all the legal questions you need to be asking about what you're about to do. Make sure you secure your communications. Then get the documents. And by the way, you've spoken, you know, to the Boston Globe about this. Where is the legal line between just taking documents and stealing documents? Where is it?
Well, don't do anything illegal. Do not try to gain unauthorized access to a computer system that you don't already have access to. Don't crack any passwords. Don't break any locks on office doors or file cabinets. Mm. Don't follow people home or plant bugs. If you have authorized access to evidence, you're allowed to secure that. You're typically allowed to share that with your lawyer and file that with regulatory agencies. Although, for instance, I'm not allowed to receive classified documents. So if you work for an intelligence agency or something like that, you couldn't just send me a bunch of classified documents. Right. I mean, the rules are pretty complicated. But you're right. You do need to secure the evidence before you can make a disclosure. Another thing is basically avoid email. I would say it's safe to say you should never use email.
Well, you also say be careful of non-disclosure agreements or any kind of confidentiality. If you've signed a contract, for instance, with a private employer saying that you will not disparage, does that limit you?
Yeah. I mean, you have to follow the law. Now, with that said, federal law does protect disclosures to the Securities and Exchange Commission and others. So if you're alleging that your company broke the securities laws, that it broke some kind of criminal or regulatory rule, those disclosures are in almost all circumstances protected, no matter what sort of NDA you signed.
You know, doesn't it also depend on how right you are? I'm thinking of Daniel Ellsberg, who stole all the papers from the Rand Corporation that he was working on that belonged to the Pentagon. Ultimately, he was right. He was pointing out serious problems about how the government viewed the Vietnam War as opposed to, you know, what they were telling the American people. You know, how much is being a whistleblower about trusting that you're right and that maybe you cut some corners?
Well, you know, I talk to people pretty regularly who have a good faith belief that something is going wrong, and they turn out to be wrong. They simply misunderstand the situation. They don't have all the facts, and that is a real risk. It really depends on the circumstances. So if you're a federal civil servant, you know, you work for an agency in Washington or something like that, the legal standard to get protections against retaliation is that you had a reasonable, good faith belief.
Huh. As you said, next thing you do, you go to some government agency, Treasury Department, a local government, you know, and file your complaint. And when do you know that that's it? You dust your hands. I did my job as a citizen. And when do you do as Frances Haugen did? You end up before Congress or others have done, and they end up, you know, with investigative journalists. When do you know to take it that far?
Every case is going to be different. That's going to depend on, first of all, what the client and the whistleblower want to do. Some whistleblowers do want media coverage. Others hope that the issues are resolved by a government agency without any reporting at all. And then obviously there's limitations based on the type of evidence. You can't just be publishing classified documents. Now, we can work to get documents declassified, but it really comes down to what makes the most sense for that client and for this case.
What was it like for you, John Tai? As we said, in 2014, you blew the whistle revealing the NSA was running that secret spying program, spying on Americans. I mean, how heart-flip-flopping is that? What was that like?
Yeah. Well, so I worked at the State Department, and my job was to work on internet freedom around the world. And while I was there, the Snowden disclosures came out about NSA spying. And during that period, came to learn that even with all of the reporting on the Snowden disclosures, there hadn't been a single article on the main legal authority that the NSA uses to collect Americans' data, which is called Executive Order 12333. And I was very concerned by this. I thought then, and you know, that it violated the Constitution, the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, and what the U.S. government's allowed to collect on Americans. My disclosure did bring attention to this, but this practice is still ongoing. I did not want to flee the country. I did not want to go to prison. There were classified elements of this. I had been in classified briefings with the NSA. So I hired lawyers, two lawyers, to help me go through the lawful disclosure process. It was exciting. It was scary. I'm proud of what I was able to do, you know, and there's more work to be done. I will say it definitely highlighted for me that there weren't enough resources for whistleblowers out there, yeah. And that's why I started Whistleblower Aid.
Do you ever counsel someone that it's not safe for them to be a whistleblower?
Every single person. Oh. Every single person, the first thing I try to tell them is the safest thing for you is to go home and pretend you never saw this.
Huh.
It's intrinsically risky, and in fact, the more significant your disclosure, the riskier it is. Now, we do everything we can to protect people, to maximize their impact while minimizing their risk, but there is no risk-free way to be a whistleblower.
Huh, and people still do it anyway. John Tighe, a lawyer who founded the D.C.-based Whistleblower Aid. They counsel whistleblowers. John, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And to add to my mention of whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, he was originally charged with conspiracy, espionage, and theft of government property for taking the Pentagon Papers from the Rand Corporation where he worked and blowing the whistle in 1971 on the government's lies about Vietnam. History vindicated him, of course, but the charges were dismissed after the Watergate investigation discovered the Nixon administration had broken into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office to try to disparage him. Again, whistleblowing is risky business.
Well, that's the HBO sound, of course. But wouldn't it be odd to hear that iconic sound before a Netflix show? It might have happened, because HBO thought about buying Netflix back in 2006, when Netflix was worth a mere $1 billion. Well, now it's all grown up and valued at $300 billion. Peter Kafka is a senior correspondent at Recode and host of the Recode Media podcast, and he's been writing about each company's legacy and this marriage that was not consummated, and he joins us now. Hey, Peter.
Hi there.
Now, HBO has had such a run over the years. The Sopranos, The Wire, Sex and the City, Game of Thrones, and now Succession. But HBO wasn't always a giant. You interviewed James Andrew Miller on your podcast. He wrote a book on HBO's history. What does it tell us about how those early days went for HBO?
Early HBO is just really an idea, a flyer hatched by executives in and around Time Inc., back when Time Inc. was a major magazine publisher and a major media company, and that's no longer the case, and they thought they might diversify and try out this weird thing called cable TV, and it starts very inauspiciously with them broadcasting to about 350 people in rural Pennsylvania, and then picks up sort of slowly after that. There's a period where in order to convince people to get HBO, they're giving away free turkeys, and it really doesn't get going until sort of the late 70s and really into the 80s.
And then since then, I mean, what are the main chapters of how HBO grew into what it is today?
The early HBO is you can't see this stuff on regular TV, which is kind of a through line for them throughout their history. But then it's at the time it's uncensored movies, comedy specials from people like George Carlin, boxing, back when boxing was a mainstream sport. There are interesting parallels between HBO's history and Netflix's history. Netflix sort of disrupted media early on in a variety of different ways, and HBO did the same. It changed the way that film studios sold their rights sold their TV rights to their movies, and eventually starts creating its own content in sort of the mid to late 80s and really gets steam in sort of the mid 90s, in part because it realizes the movie studios don't really want to do business with it in the same way that they always have. And if you follow Netflix, you'll notice some of the parallels with Netflix.
Yeah, let's talk about Netflix. Once upon a time, and many of us remember, it was this mail-in the DVD company. And now, of course, it's this standard bearer for streaming content. What did Netflix learn from HBO, and what did it figure out itself about growing into what it is today?
I mean, Netflix, for a long time, like you said, was a DVD by mail business. It always wanted to stream stuff, but I'm not sure they sort of thought about what they were going to stream. But at some point, in the same way that HBO realized that the major studios were going to change the way they sold their content to HBO, Netflix realized that
the major studios were going to stop making their stuff available to Netflix subscribers, and Netflix was going to have to make its own content. It famously jumped into that world in 2013 with House of Cards. At the time, Netflix said specifically, we want to become HBO. So they were consciously modeling themselves, at least initially, on sort of an, what was then considered an HBO style of programming.
Now, we never know how mergers will go, and HBO had its own tobacco with AOL Time Warner years ago. But based on what you know about these two companies, could a marriage of HBO and Netflix have worked out?
I don't think it would have worked out. I mean, it's easy to bet against big companies acquiring small companies, particularly big established media companies acquiring internet companies. There's a very checkered history of that. There are very few successes of that. And the reason that Netflix was able to succeed in a lot of ways is because it wasn't a major media company. It didn't have the same rules to follow from Wall Street. It could go years without making money. Time Warner couldn't have done that. And because it didn't have access to things like HBO, it had to create its own content. It's very easy to imagine HBO acquiring Netflix in 2006 and then not really knowing what to do with it and certainly not wanting to compete with itself and its established business model. So it's a fun coulda, woulda, shoulda. It's unlikely we end up in a world where there's no Netflix.
Now going forward, back to HBO, I mean, it was the first, but now it's one of many media companies producing premium content. Is it innovating enough to remain a leader?
I mean, it is certainly, it certainly has a brand and an association, and I think people still hold it up as sort of the best consistent creator of television, movies to a lesser extent. But it no longer has that space entirely to itself, and it's going up against the likes of Netflix and deep-pocketed competitors like Amazon and Apple, Disney. So it will have to figure out some way where it can distinguish itself against. It used to have that fielding entirely to itself, and now it doesn't.
Yeah. Peter Kafka, senior correspondent at Recode and host of the Recode Media podcast. Peter, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. This is Here and Now.